Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and we're going to have a lot of fun today. We've got lots of things we can talk about. I want to talk about garden safety just a little bit with you, because we don't do that very often. And our guest today, UW Extension Agriculture and Horticulture Agent Scott Royce, knows a lot about that, and he also knows a lot about handling pesticides and fertilizers, about some of the damage that may have been caused to your garden by cold snaps. There's all kinds of things we can talk about with him today, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
I'm very glad to be here.
It's wonderful having you as a guest today. And we already have callers coming up online with questions, but let's talk a little bit about safety. I saw a number, I think Jill Nadeau provided it for me, emergency room treatments totaled about 400,000 in terms of garden tool related accidents, and that happens every year. 400,000 people are injured and have to go to the emergency room due to some gardening related accident.
Yeah, that's not too surprising. I hadn't looked up the actual numbers, but I certainly believe it with all the stories I hear.
How do people get in trouble? What do they do?
Well, there's lots of different things. I mean, you know, obviously, anytime you're dealing with a power tool, there is a risk of injury. Whether you're fixing it, maintaining it, or using it, you have to be cautious when you're doing anything with that has more power than we do. How's that? So, you know, a lot of things are, you know, with mowers and string trimmers. Those tend to be the ones that cause the most injuries for the average homeowner. But anytime you start bringing something like a chainsaw or you know, some of the edgers or some of those types of things that have even more power behind them, those are the ones that can really cause long-term damage and those emergency room visits in a heartbeat.
Yeah, and so I guess your advice probably for those kinds of things is, hey, know how to use the equipment and then be careful.
Yeah, know how to use it. Know the safety stuff that goes with it. My kids kind of look funny at me quite often because I won't use the lawnmower, the string trimmer, or anything like that without having hearing protection on. You know, coming from a farm family background, that's one of the things that has been driven home to me time after time. And so many farm families I deal with where you have to use your outside voice when you're at the dining table because people have been exposed to so much hearing damage over the course of their careers in farming. And home equipment can do the same thing. You know, something simple like wearing good gloves when you're using even hand tools, you know, like you were talking about hand tools before. And with the chainsaw in particular, you got to have the right gear on if you're doing something like that. You've got to, you know, steel toe boots, the actual wearing chaps, having a full helmet on. With string trimmers too, the number of eye injuries that happen because of people not wearing goggles or a full face safety shield, which is really what's recommended.
Wow. And of course, so we got tools, but then also people using chemicals and using those chemicals properly, I think, is important.
Yeah, a little bit different side of the safety aspect within the home landscape, certainly, where it's less immediate of an injury usually. But certainly, we still have the opportunity to have immediate allergic reactions to any type of chemical. It could be something as benign in most people's minds as a fertilizer, but people can have allergic reactions to them. And then, of course, we can also have both acute and chronic toxicity issues when we start dealing with pesticides.
Yeah.
You know, in a county extension office, we get literally every kind of phone call that people can imagine. And the unfortunate ones usually start with, I did X, you know, practice with something, and should I be concerned? And it's like, yes. Yeah. When I start talking about pesticide safety with people, the first thing that I always say is read the label. I don't care what kind of pesticide it is that you are using. You are using something meant to kill something. That should trigger alarm bells going off in your head as far as safety. So start there, read the label, understand it, and really understand for yourself, why are you using this? Am I using the right kind of product, and am I using it the right way? And then am I following the safety procedures beyond that? One of the biggest things to remind people and to try to get people to do is to just simply follow the base safety stuff. You know, just about every pesticide labeled for use in the United States has a statement on it, something along the lines of wear long sleeves, long pants, full shoes and socks.
Yep.
there aren't any pesticides out there that say, yeah, I'm safe. Go ahead, spray me when you got, you know, shorts, tank top, and flip-flops on. There aren't anything out there. Are no products out there that are going to have a statement like that on their label.
So something definitely to think about with our guest, Scott Royce. By the way, he's broadcasting from our Green Bay studio, so it's great to have him with us today. And you can join in. Almost all our lines are filled, but the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. And you know what? Bill in Ashland has, let's see if I can get Bill on. Bill, are you there?
I'm here.
What's on your mind?
Well, you guys, you know, you're talking about safety today. And that I got a suggestion that when you're rolling up your extension cord, if you're using an outdoor tool, always unplug it first. Because, boy, you know, when you're sliding that cord through your hand and, you know, to get it back into a coil, sometimes you might hit a hot spot.
Yeah. Has that happened to you, Bill?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
wasn't very pleasant, but it sure wakes you up, I'll tell you.
Well, you know, that's it. You get it. And I've got some cord. I've got a cord. I have an electric lawnmower, okay?
Yeah.
And I've run over that cord.
Yeah.
And I've nicked it, and I've got some electrician tape. And I tape it up right away. But
oh, yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Unplug that. Thanks a lot for calling. Scott, you're going to go along with that, aren't you?
Well, to an extent, yeah. Yeah, anytime you start dealing with electricity in the outdoors, you have a totally different level of electrical safety concerns, especially with the equipment. You know, you mentioned lawnmowers. I've seen the string trimmer types of even electric chainsaws. And, yeah, it's very easy to, as you mentioned, nick that power cord and not do enough damage that you cut current, but do enough to the insulation that you can then become a ground for that power. And if you damage a cord like that, you know, not that I'm haranguing against your statement, Larry, but the best fix for that is to replace the cord completely, not just try to tape it up, because that's really not probably the best insulation for those types of situations, because unless it's absolutely perfectly done, you're still going to have exposure to the elements to that line, and you're going to have the pretty easy potential for seeing current coming through that weakness there.
A shocking experience could come
definitely.
Your way. Oh, boy. Well, we've got Margaret in Cornell's been waiting a little while. Let's go there. Margaret, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm experimenting with raised bed gardens this year, and I'm on my way to I'm not going to say the store's name, but I want to know what's the difference between bagged dirt, like topsoil, bagged manure, and some of those enhanced, like the Miracle-Gro or potting soil. Which one, what's the difference, and which one is a better one for my raised beds?
So you're trying to, so now you've got flat ground and you want to raise it up, and what should you apply is what you're asking.
Right. I'm using, mm-hmm. like, containers, like large swimming pool-sized containers.
Okay.
Kiddie swimming pools.
Okay.
Okay. So actual containers and not really raised beds.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, and the reason I asked, or as far as clarification, is that there is a little bit of difference there in how you want to approach the installation of those things. When it's truly a raised bed, you need to make sure to actually integrate the soil underneath that with what you're adding. Otherwise, it becomes a container, and you're really short-circuiting the growth potential of the vegetables, flowers, fruits, whatever it is that you're going to be raising inside of that raised bed. So what I generally recommend is you using the base topsoil around there, adding organic matter, compost, different products like that to supplement what's in the soil, but to make sure that you integrate the top layers of the soil underneath. Otherwise, the roots growing through there will hit that old soil, so to speak, and basically just stop and, yeah, you know, turn and not want to go underneath it. But in a container situation, as you're talking, there we really want to go with things that are going to be plant healthy and plant friendly, but also a little bit friendlier for you to be able to utilize and not have to do any extra long-term management. So normally in a container situation, you're going to want to use either a compost base because that way you're going to be able to get all 17 of those minerals that the plants need to get out of the soil. You're going to be able to get all of those minerals in a fairly balanced manner over time with some potential opportunities for needing additional nitrogen or something like that on some crops. But you're going to have all those micronutrients available that way and not have the literal mass of weight that you would have by adding a true topsoil into a container. Now, mixing a topsoil and a compost in a really large container like what you're talking about is going to be perfectly fine, and we'll set that up for a long-term use, you know, for multiple years. But if you really only want to use a container for 1 year, you can probably get by as cheaply by just using a straight, very mature compost or a good potting mix. Now, you mentioned a couple of brand names that, you know, like the Miracle-Gro type of products, and there are dozens of different brand names out there. They all have the same types of longer-term, slow-release type fertilizers available within them, in addition to the compost base that they usually have. And those are certainly very good products to utilize, especially if you don't want to have to micromanage throughout the growing season. If you use a straight topsoil, a lot of times you're going to have to end up adding nutrients to those containerized plants because they just don't have the soil mass available to them that like they would in a more normal garden setting.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. A compost like the bagged manure, or the compost with the added fertilizer is the way I should go.
At least as part of it. And then, like I say, it's kind of up to you if you want to work with the weight of true topsoil. It's certainly not a bad thing, especially with the size of containers that it sounds like you're going to be using, because it will be a little bit cheaper than using a straight compost or compost manure. And it does depend a little bit on what you're growing as to how much nutrient availability there that you're going to need for those plants.
I'm just putting some tomatoes and peppers and that sort of thing in them because my garden is shaded, and I never get a very good production of tomatoes and peppers. So I thought if I put them outside of my fence in the sunshine, that would help.
Yeah, good way to do it. And a lot of northern gardeners that I deal with have very limited sunshine, and their vegetable gardens literally have to be mobile so that they can follow the sun from week to week. So, you know, they'll use containers, they'll put them on carts or on wagons or at least on wheels in some way, shape, or form and be able to do just what you described. And it's one of the only ways that we can get good production in some of our spots in the state.
Yeah.
Well, perfect.
All right. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Steve in Montreal has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling, Steve.
Good morning, Larry. I'm sitting out here on the front deck looking at my lawn, which I am looking at one of those little yellow blooms that sticks its head up occasionally. And I try to cut them all out with a little digger.
Yep.
So they don't go in Indiana. We said they went to seed, that white fluffy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my next door neighbor, who's a native Wisconsin boy, a North Country boy, doesn't seem to agree with me in that regard. Now, am I correct in cutting them out by the roots so they don't go to seed, that white fluffy stuff? What do you think?
Well, certainly the seed heads are those, the fluffy seeds, and they're wind-blown. You know, dandelion is a wind-blown seed, very, very nice, very fun for kids to play with. You know, it's one of the easiest ways to keep kids and grandkids amused is send them off to a dandelion field. But in the lawn, they are one of our biggest weed problems. And the step-back statement to this is, remember that when you're seeing weeds in your lawn, they're actually more a symptom of the problem than the problem itself. The problem is there's a bare spot, and nature hates bare spots, so it fills it with something. Now, and unfortunately, turf management in the state of Wisconsin, especially on some of our soils, is kind of hard. You know, we have a hard time managing a perfect turf. You know, we can't all have the money that Lambeau Field has to manage their turf, but we can at least try to do things as best we can. So when it comes to managing dandelions, certainly physical management, like you're talking about, of digging out individual plants is a great way to do it, but it's also pretty intensive, you know, both labor and physical-wise. And you know, it gets back into that safety aspect we started the show with on kind of doing your stretching and paying attention to how you're doing those things.
I'm ahead of the game right now.
Good for you.
But having as healthy of a lawn as possible, so mowing as tall as your mower will allow you to do, you know, 3, 3.5, even 4 inches in certain settings, you know, in shaded situations, you can go that tall. Properly fertilizing and watering according to your management desires, and I'll leave it at that because that's a whole discussion on how to have lawn management. But then also, if you really need to go down that road, utilizing one of the properly labeled herbicides, usually one of the ones containing 2,4-D or one of the three-way lawn herbicides, which end up having 2,4-D, MCPP, as well as dicamba in them. With dandelion, there's two best times to spray a herbicide if you want to control dandelions and other perennial broadleaves. The best time from an efficiency standpoint is actually about mid-September, that early fall standpoint, because they're sending all their energy reserves down into the roots, so you get a better efficacy. The next best time is when they're at full bloom. So if you are going to go down the herbicide road, those are the best two times. But with the taproot that dandelions have, you do really have to dig them out if you want to actually kill that plant, because they have a pretty impressive ability to regrow.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
Thanks, Steve, so much for calling. I appreciate your call.
Thank you for your help.
You bet.
Yep.
Our guest today, Scott Royce, UW Extension Ag and Horticulture Agent from Marinette County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Scott Royce, Hort and Ag Agent from Marinette County. And Scott mentioned Lambeau Field, and that reminded me that I will be in Green Bay at Lambeau Field on the evening of Thursday, June 22nd. This is going to be a lot of fun. There is a tail. Well, let's see. What we're going to do, a little tour of Lambeau Field later in the afternoon. Then we're going to have a sort of a mock radio program, I guess we could say, with the Packer historian Cliff Crystal and Packer president Mark Murphy. And Mark is a big public radio fan, so. And he's a Joy Cardine fan as well. And Joy Cardine's going to be there along with Mike Crane. I'll be there. We'll do that. We'll do that sort of mock program, and we'll be bringing in some other folks who are intimately connected with the Packers. And so I think that's going to be a lot of fun. And then we're just going to have a tailgate. Well, we'll eat something, we'll drink something, and we'll have ourselves a really good time. That's Thursday, June 22nd. And if you want a ticket to that, you just go to WPR.org/100. So WPR.org/100. If you don't want to do that, you can call too. The number is 1-800-747-7444. 1-800-747-7444. And the next day on Friday, I'll be doing my Garden Talk show from the Green Bay Botanical Garden. So looking forward to that as well. That's going to be a lot of fun. But get your tickets for that Green Bay Packer event on Thursday, June 22nd. Well, maybe you've got a question for our guest today, Scott Royce. If you do, give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's take another call. Dennis in Appleton up next. Dennis, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about, I've seen some, in my neighborhood, some lawn care companies applying sprayed-on fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides to extremely wet lawns. Like this spring, we had, you know, a lot of rain.
Yep.
I saw them applying it during the rain.
No.
And I'm wondering what the danger of migration of those products are to other areas.
Okay. The biggest answer there is probably that it depends on precisely what was being applied is the most honest answer. But in general, most of the active ingredients that are going to be utilized on a lawn are ones that need to be taken up by the roots anyway. So applying relatively soon before rain happens probably won't hurt the efficacy. Applying during a rain, that's one of those where you kind of go back to the label, and I'm pretty sure that's not going to be found on any label as far as actually applying during a rainfall. So you're going to probably lose some efficacy there, and there is going to be a risk of runoff in a situation like that if it's a heavier rain. Now, if it's a, you know, a sprinkly, misty type of thing, realistically speaking, probably very little additional risk other than the application itself. But if we would happen to go from a, you know, a light drizzle to a torrential downpour even for a moment or two, yeah, there's some potential issues there. So you always want to be careful with paying attention to timing. Now, one thing I will say, though, is that there are some lawn products that actually recommend being applied when the lawn is wet from a dew. You know, if you're using a granular formulation of a 2,4-D product, for example, you actually want that to stick to the leaves because 2,4-D has to get taken up through the leaves, not through the roots. It's one of our rare pesticides as far as lawn use goes. That's why usually 2,4-D products are sprayed on rather than apply by professional companies, at least. But the homeowner formulations are usually the weed and feed type of products, those fertilizers that contain an impregnated 2,4-D product. And those, right on the label, it's going to say, if possible, apply while the leaves are still wet, because that's the best way to get that herbicidal active ingredient into the plants that you're trying to kill.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you so much, Dennis, for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to another Dennis, this one in Elkhorn. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
I live in a rural area, and I have a lot of bur oak trees. And last year, to save myself some labor of blowing the leaves out, I mulched them with a lawnmower. And most of my ground is very sandy, but I do have some good, rich soil on the east side of my driveway. However, what I found this spring is my grass all over the place was very poor, and I'm wondering if the tannic from those leaves that I mulched in could be the problem.
Definitely shouldn't have been, no. There isn't enough anti-growth properties in oak leaves to affect things. The only way it would have been an issue is if the leaf material was literally so heavy that it actually shaded out the crowns of the turf grasses, but that's pretty unlikely if you mulch them the way it sounds like you did.
Yeah, they were you know, went over them 3-4 times, and you know, they were just very small chips.
Yeah. Shouldn't have been a problem.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if the leaves were related to the thinning of the lawn. It could have been some other conditions. You know, on your sandier soils, you may have actually had a little bit of winter dieback. We had another one of those winters where we had a lot of variation in temperature, so that could have been part of it. You know, if you haven't had a soil test done on your lawn in the last 5 years or so, and you know, you might be running out of potassium on that soil, and that definitely is a factor in winter survival of our turfs.
That sounds like a good suggestion. I'm going to do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dennis. Appreciate it. Warren in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Warren. Thank you for calling.
Gentlemen, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two sections on my property here in Madison. The front section has Austrian pines on it, and there's no weeds underneath whatsoever. In the back, I have a berm area probably 30 feet long, 20 feet up the berm. that now has Austrian pines, a good 20 years old, but all kinds of weeds. So I'd like to get rid of the weeds without using a weed killer. Is there another ecological way to do that? They're very thick.
Okay. Well, settings like that, there's probably no one single answer, I guess, is the honest approach for me. You can certainly do a combination of some things. You can add some extra mulch layers underneath there. You can do some hand control of the problematic weed species, the ones that are going to spread more easily, and obviously that's going to kind of be dictated by what precisely is there. But mulching, if you want to try to use some of the organic types of herbicides that don't have some of the potential risks that some of the other things do, you could try using something along the lines of like a corn gluten meal. The herbicidal vinegars, they're an opportunity. I'm not a huge fan of them myself because they're just as problematic health-wise for people as some of the actual herbicides, there's the occasional misuse issue with those things. But I'm a little bit surprised to see it. It's probably a combination of the way the sun is hitting the soil differently on that berm situation.
Yep.
So it is definitely going to be a tougher situation to deal with those weeds because,
there's a good layer of mulch underneath already from the pine. So, again, in the front there's nothing. I was thinking of the roofing felt that they put on roofs or used to put on roofs. In other words, it's like 4 feet wide and 20 feet long. Mm-hmm. To see if I could lay down some strips of that and kill the weeds off by denying sunlight.
Yeah. Well,
and then mulch afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah, or from a safety standpoint, I'd lean toward using something like a landscape fabric or an actual black plastic rather than a roofing product, because we can actually put some chemicals into the soil from those types of products, too, that aren't really going to be highly favorable for the rest of our plants.
Oh, no, I like that. That's good. I tell you what, I will try this. I've got nothing to lose, and I will let you know later what's happening.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Another product you can actually use in a setting like that will decay over time but hopefully take care of the weeds in the short term and then allow your other stuff to get in front of it is just straight cardboard. If you happen to have, piled up cardboard at home or have access to something like that, it's another opportunity. Obviously, a little bit trickier to apply sometimes. You almost have to kind of staple it down, but with long staples.
That gets wet, too, but...
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try a few in different sections, and I'll let you know what's happening.
Yeah, it sounds good. And that will, over time, it's going to disintegrate, as opposed to the black plastic, which you'd have to pull that black plastic up before you then put down mulch, I think, Scott, right?
Well, that's why landscape fabric would be an alternative to hopefully manage most of the weeds, but be able to put the mulch right on top of it, because the landscape fabric will allow moisture to go through it. Certainly with plastic, you're going to probably want to just basically use that as a killing point for the weeds and then remove it and put your heavier mulch layer down on top of it, or where it was.
Yep, there we go. Thanks, Warren. Good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. On to Mike in Jackson next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have an issue with, I grow pumpkins every year, and it seems like my population has gone down and down. I get good germination of the seed, good healthy plants and everything. I got a ton of blossoms, but I get very few pumpkins, and it's a pretty good sized batch. I mean, I've had different sizes, but I mean, 30 by 50, and I might get six pumpkins, or, it's just pretty dismal.
Okay.
And I have a lot of bees. I have a bee hives right down the street, real close, and everything else, so that's not it.
Okay. Well, you kind of started eliminating one of the things I was going to be asking you about the bumblebee population in the area. I mean, honeybees can pollinate the vine crops fairly well, but bumblebees are actually the most efficient of the vine crop pollinators. One of the things that I ran into last year with a commercial farm in Oconee County, a commercial pumpkin operation, was that their vines simply weren't producing female flowers. And it was because of the temperature variations we had and the cultivars that they had planted. So they had fantastic-looking vines, great numbers of male flowers, and there simply weren't any female flowers. They were like you. I mean, they could practically count the number of pumpkins that they had, and that was per acre, you know, not just per smaller area like that. So that could have been one thing, especially last year, that could have been the situation there. So that's always one thing to look at is are you actually getting female and male flowers at the same time? Because that can happen with our vine crops, on any of our vine crops in reality, is that we don't have proper timing of the male and female flowers coming out so that our pollinators can do their jobs.
Scott, do you recommend, are there some pumpkin varieties that you recommend over others?
Not particularly. Most of them are pretty good. We tend to have more issues with some of the winter squashes than with pumpkins in those regards. But most of the pumpkins have been selected for, you know, pretty consistent flower production. But when we get stretches of abnormally cool or abnormally hot weather, the vines will often produce only one sex of flower, so only male or only female flowers, and then that throws off their whole fruit set for the entire year. So unfortunately, you know, in the state of Wisconsin, nature wins. You know, if nature decides to make something happen, it's going to happen that way, and we only we have to adjust to what we're given.
Yeah, for sure.
So that would be one thing, you know, to just watch for. And unfortunately, there isn't all that much we can do for it.
Also, my soil's real sandy. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try to really beef it up this year. Years ago, I got a ton of manure. I had a neighbor just spread loads and loads on it. I think it was better at that time, but mm-hmm. I'm going to try to at least really get some compost and manure and put it around all the hills and really try to beef it up. Maybe that'll help. I don't know.
It's possible that one of the micronutrients or even a macronutrient is deficient as well. But if the plant growth in general looked fairly good, you know, it's a little bit lower likelihood, but it's certainly worth investing some time and effort. You know, I'm always a huge fan of getting extra organic matter into our sandier soils, as that's mostly what I work with up in the three counties I work in. And, you know, it adds water holding potential, it adds temperature stability, and it obviously also adds the micronutrient and nutrient holding capacity, as well as availability.
Yeah, good points. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Let's go to Don next in Dunn. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry and your guest. I have a question. Virginia creeper is something that my family is extremely toxic to in terms of it's like poison ivy, only worse. And I don't know how – is there any way that you can kill it besides – pulling it up?
Well, you can try one kind of what we call the cut and paint method of treatment with, you know, as long as you are truly dealing with Virginia creeper, which is one of our native vines, you know, woody perennial vine. Certainly pulling it is no fun because it's pretty aggressive and roots very readily.
And if you have an allergic reaction to it, you can't do it.
Yeah, you got to wear gloves. And I'll be dealing with that kind of situation myself because I've got a garlic mustard patch at home that I've got to finish pulling. But, of course, the last part that's left is in a big poison ivy patch. So, So, yeah, obviously you have to take care of yourself first and foremost, but there are a number of herbicidal products that could be utilized in a situation like that if you're willing to do it. The most effective as far as the use of an active ingredient would be what we call cut and paint, where you find the base of the plant, literally cut it off with the pruners, and then immediately paint that cut surface with a full-strength glyphosate or one of the other brush-killer-type products. There's about four different active ingredients that can actually work against those things. The problem with Virginia creeper is because it can root along the entire length of vine that hits the soil, some individual plants, that method is not going to work very well because they have literally they just have too much of a root system. So there you may actually have to go to a foliar application. But the problem with anything that will kill Virginia creeper from a herbicidal standpoint is also going to kill just about any other broadleaf in the area at a minimum, if not literally everything else in the area. So it's a situational problem that you're going to have to really analyze what you are willing to do as far as supplemental damage around that area as to whether or not any of those methods are going to work for you.
In terms of herbicides, getting down and clipping and pasting is hard too, because it's hard to keep your clothes and your gloves and everything from getting. But the herbicide, what would you use for that? I mean, just
well, if you're going to do if you're going to do the cut and paint application, you know, like I say, glyphosate works just is. Yep. The most easily available, but there are other, you know, other brush killer type products that would work. If you're going to do a foliar application, I'm trying to think of which ones would be the best. You could utilize a glyphosate there. It theoretically can work fairly well, but you're going to have to be very careful about other stuff. If you have grass around the area and you don't want to kill the grass, there are some broadleaf type products out there that should work to some extent on that. Even up to like some of the three-way products that we mentioned that have, as long as they have dicamba in them, they may have some decent applicability. That's one that I'm blanking out on some of the other possibility that would be the best possibilities for that particular situation. So you may want to check in with your own local county extension office where they have all their resources in front of them, because I don't want to say the wrong thing here.
Right, for sure. Well, thanks a lot for calling, Don. Appreciate your call. Scott Royce, our guest today, UW Extension Agriculture and Horticulture Agent for Marinette County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to welcome Scott Royce as our guest, UW Extension Ag and Horticulture Agent for Marinette County. Questions for Scott, call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Alan on Facebook says, last year two of his butterfly milkweed plants looked stunted and yellow, a bit yellow. This year, six or seven of them are that way. Any ideas as to what might cause that with his butterfly milkweed plants?
There's only so many things that affect them. There are a couple of diseases that can get into a stand of a milkweed population and cause problems for them. You know, there are, you know, as with any plants, I mean, there are various viruses and mycoplasmas that could potentially be doing that. It'd be unusual to see, you know, root rot or crown rot or anything along those lines with milkweeds, because they usually aren't very susceptible to them. So I'd lean toward something along those lines as my first guess, unless something has changed in the area. That would be changing the soil conditions pretty dramatically, any type of a potential herbicide contamination issue or, you know, unplanned or herbicide use. But again, with milkweed, not that common, so it'd be one of those where I'd, you know, to get a really good answer, I'd probably have to see the type of yellowing. But if it's the whole plants that are actually yellowing, it could be one of those insidious diseases like the mycoplasmas or viruses.
Now, Paul in Racine is up next. So let's go to, let's see. There's Paul. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi. thank you for taking my call. Let's see. I have some, I believe they're either ornamental crab trees or ornamental cherry trees in my yard. And every year I trim off these vertical branches that start growing out of the top of the trees.
Yeah.
And Every year they grow back, and every year I trim them off again.
Yep. What time of the
year? Any way to control those things, or
what time of the year do you do your pruning?
I do it. I'll call it late winter, early spring.
Okay. There's a trick with that. When you're working with a tree and it responds in a way that you don't want it to with that extra growth like that, try changing your timing. The next best, you know, normally we talk about doing our fruit tree pruning and stuff like that in, you know, later March or, you know, mid-March, et cetera, depending on where you are in the state. But mid to late July can also be a very good time to deal with those types of trees that don't act the way you want them to, because of where the energy is stored. You know, in spring or in winter pruning, the energy is below ground, and when it moves back up, the tree wants to fill those spaces that we just made by doing our pruning cuts. Whereas in mid to late summer, we're, as long as it's, you know, been reasonably dry and we don't have extreme disease risk or something, we can do some of our pruning at that point, and the tree usually doesn't respond with regrowth at minimum as quickly or as much, you know. So that would be the first recommendation, would be to change your timing. Otherwise, the other way to approach it is to try to have some level of hormonal control, because the uppermost and outermost buds on a branch or a portion of a tree actually produce hormones that inhibit the growth of the rest of that branch or portion of tree. So that's why you never want to flat top a tree. Because it releases all of the hormonal control within the tree, and it becomes a raging mess, for lack of a better way of saying it.
Oh, well, I think that's what I've been doing then. Because I've been trying to kid just from the aesthetic standpoint. You know, I like the way that these trees sit. They look nice with a relatively flat top, so that they're more... They more have a horizontal look to them.
Okay, yep. Then I would try. I would look more at timing and try to do that in that, like I say, that mid to late summer. You know, for me, where I work, it's mostly, we're talking, you know, that later July, first week or two of August is a pretty good time to do that type of pruning if we need to.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Green Bay. Tom's up there. Tom, hi.
Hi. Question I got is, I got a bunch of moss in my yard. It's kind of taken over the grass and everything. I've got mature oak trees. I've got real sandy soil. It used to have a great lawn, but now the sand is starting to come up. I'm also, I've put a moss inhibitor down. To see if that'll work. I just put that on a couple days ago. But the other thing I'm looking at is, would it be good to overseed that with, and then put in a little topsoil and compost and the sphagnum moss, a mix with the seed in it, and just how would I spread that out and get rid of the moss on top of it?
Okay. One of those fun situations, again, you know, dealing with lawns and anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, is you're going to have your challenges, but particularly if you are dealing with a sandier soil, you know, turf grass is like consistency, and sand is the absolute antithesis of consistency, because soil temperature goes up and down, the water availability goes up and down, and nutrient consistency just isn't there. So,
And then add in mature oaks.
Well, yeah, to an extent, yeah, you get the shade. You got all those other factors too. So, again, you know, it kind of goes back to an earlier discussion we had. Moss is not the problem. We think it's the problem, but the reality is it's the symptom. The symptom is, okay, something is going on with that soil area. Generally, moss is going to be able to outcompete turf grasses only when we have a relatively low pH in the soil, which in the Green Bay area shouldn't be happening, but it's always a slight possibility. We have really infertile soil conditions, and again, shouldn't happen in the Green Bay area, but it's always a slight chance. And then the other reasons are usually a little bit more common, is where we have compaction or low drainage or something along those lines. Certainly, your idea of reseeding and overseeding is a good one. Kind of a tough time of the year to do that because we're starting to enter our sunnier, longer days, you know, higher soil temperatures. You can still try it, but you may be better served to wait until, you know, later August, you know, mid to late August to do that type of thing. But, it's worth trying, especially if you do have that shady areas that you're talking about. You can probably still get those grasses to get started effectively. Basically, about the best ways to do it is probably to just literally physically rake up the moss, get that off of there, and then do your overseeding and go over it again, either with a light raking or if you have the ability to roll it at all to get better seed-to-soil contact, and do what we can to get those seedlings started. And then, of course, pay attention to water availability in that upper quarter inch or so of soil when you're trying to get those seedlings established.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Tom, for calling. And Bob in Brookfield, it is your turn. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So I'm trying to restore a prairie area in a relatively small area, about an acre or so, in Jefferson County. So what I did is I killed off everything with Roundup, and I mowed it all down, raked it to expose the soil. And then this past spring, I planted some prairie grass seed, some wildflower seed, and then in an effort to crowd out the weeds, which I knew would come back, I planted some oats this last spring. And the oats are coming up fine. They look nice. However, there's still a lot of weeds, a lot of thistle, stinging nettle, dandelions, etc. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can spray on there that will kill those weeds but will not harm the oats or the grass.
Mm. There's a really easy answer to this question. No. Unfortunately, there is literally nothing that you can spray that's going to take out a wide range of weeds and not either take out all of the grasses or all of the broad leaves or potentially all of both. So when you're dealing with a prairie restoration situation like that, your best and you're not a professional, okay, there are a few tools out there that if you're a restricted use pesticide applicator, you might be able to pull off a few things. But in general, it's patience, judicious use of mowing, and then down the road doing proper prairie management as best you're able to in your municipality, because there are some municipalities that don't allow burning, which is really what we need to use to be able to manage a prairie area properly. Hmm. But getting those oats cut off before they go to seed, getting those weeds cut off before they go to seed, that's the only way to win the battle in the long term, is to prevent seed bank restoration of those weeds. And the unfortunate thing with prairie, both grasses and the broadleaf plants, you know, those wildflowers, as you mentioned, they take a long time to get established. So you're really not going to see too many of those things until later in this year, and even going into next year, some of them may not really become visible until then.
Mm. Oh, okay. So patience is key.
But yeah, and for you, it may be mowing, proper mowing.
Yep.
Is going to really make a difference.
Yeah, and those seedlings can come up through, you know, a little bit of mulch. So, you know, it's not like you need to bag that material or anything like that. Just try to, you know, get it mown normally and let it help the soil as best you can.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Rudy in Pewaukee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Hey, I have a question. We have a part of our yard that grew kind of wild, and we're trying to clean it out. And there's a weed there now that it has kind of a woody rhizome that's just at the top of the soil, and some of it's under the soil, and it has five leaves on each stem. Do you know what that is?
What do the leaves look like?
Mm-hmm.
They're like connected to like a little stem at the center of the stalk.
Okay, so they're kind of like
a pyramid shaped.
Are they okay? Pyramid shaped, you said?
Spearmint shaped leaves.
Oh, spearmint.
Could be. I mean, it sounds a little bit like a species we were talking about before with Virginia creeper, because that can do that kind of thing. There are some other native species as well as introduced species that can look that way. You know, management of them is going to be relatively similar no matter which one it is. It's either going to be physical control or going through and doing individual herbicidal management, kind of like what we were talking about with the Virginia creeper earlier in the show, with either, you know, cut and paint type of management or a broader application, but with a pretty severe risk of causing damage to a lot of other plants in that spot.
Right.
But doing identification of weeds is always fun, especially when you're trying to do it over the phone. So if in doubt, you know, take a sample in to somebody that you trust, preferably your local extension office or some, you know, a plant professional that you trust, and get it ID'd so that you know for sure. Because the first stage of any type of pest management protocol is to know what you're dealing with, because then you can find its weak point and make sure that we're actually managing it both efficiently and effectively.
Yeah.
This is some nasty stuff, too, because we've been trying to pull it and spray it for the last couple of years now. And
It just doesn't work. Yeah, you need to get that plant identified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're dealing with a rhizomatous system like it sounds like you are, it's very easy for them to regrow.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, thanks very much for calling. Good luck, Rudy. Appreciate your call. Our guest today is Scott Royce. Scott is a UW Extension Agriculture and Horticulture agent. He works out of Marinette County, but actually works with three counties and does a wonderful job. Our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today is Scott Royce, UW Extension Agriculture and Horticulture agent for Marinette County. Questions for him about your garden or maybe your lawn or your trees, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. It's Christine in Mount Pleasant up next with a question. Christine, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I last year took out some very overgrown bushes with result in horrible amount of weeds or roots. I would like to plant hydrangea this year. It's partial shade, so that's good. How many do I have to, like, dig out, like, a foot under to get rid of the roots? Can there be some roots there and still the plant survives? Should I just rototiller it as much as I can? What do you suggest?
Those roots will not be an issue for the plants that you put there. The types of fungi that will be degrading those dead roots are not ones that are going to attack your new plant. So you shouldn't have to be concerned about that at all. The only situation where you would really have to worry about what is in those root systems is if you lost plants due to particular diseases. But if you took them out on your own accord, just because of, you know, redoing things, there shouldn't really be any issues at all. So I would not be spending extra time working and turmoil working on trying to get those roots out, because they will not be an issue for your new plants.
And one more thing, because eventually when you go, 8 inches down, I run into clay, and I always dig out as much as I can and stick good garden soil down. Is that what you would do too?
It's an option to consider, or just adding organic matter to it. It's a philosophical approach as much as anything. You know, I tend to try to work with the base soil that's there rather than trying to force something in it that isn't as natural of a situation, because that's my approach, because I prefer to have things matching what we have, and then the long-term adaptation is usually better. So, but it's not a bad approach to amend the soil with the extra materials, but I do tend to lean more toward organic matter amendments and longer-term approaches like that, rather than trying to do short-term fixes by adding new soil, so to speak.
All right.
Okay. When they ask for well-drained soil, isn't clay the opposite? It's not good drained?
Relatively, yeah. Clay certainly has its issues from a drainage standpoint, but you do have to do selection a little bit differently and making sure that you are at least having plants that can handle temporary drainage issues. Now, clay doesn't necessarily mean that they're always going to have wet feet, so we can get by with quite a few things that say, you know, poor drainage, not great for them, but we at least have to be a little bit cautious on maybe exactly where we're locating them so that we don't have extra water being associated with that particular area. Those would be more factors than those plants could probably deal with in the long run.
All right.
One more thing. The organic material, is that what you mean by, what do you mean by organic material?
There's a whole litany of options, and whatever's cheapest is what I recommend. So if you have, you know, composted manure, working leaves in the fall, even, you know, pine needles, straw, old hay, whatever you have access to that's easy for you to utilize as well as relatively low cost.
All right.
Thank you for all your answers.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Pat in Racine, what's on your mind?
Horsetail,
okay.
I'm trying to get rid of it and can't find any salad recipes for it, but nothing seems to, nothing organic seems to work at all.
By horsetail, do you mean the what I call Equisetum, which is the genus name, but that rougher plant with, you know, it's fairly wispy looking on top, but fairly rough individual thin leaves?
Doesn't have leaves at all.
Okay, yeah, that's Equisetum. Okay. Yes, that is an ancient plant as far as plant genetics go. When I'm dealing with people I know really well, I jokingly say, well, small thermonuclear devices are good, but it's hard to get the permit. It's tough there that because that is a it's literally a different genetic base when you come to the plant world working with that. So there are only so many options that are going to work. And then when you add in trying to not use some of our harsher herbicides, it really becomes a matter of patience, tillage, hoeing, pulling, black plastic, clear plastic, something along those lines, depending on precisely what you're willing to do in a particular area, and how big the area is and how big the patch is. Because obviously the bigger the patch is, the more energy is going to be able to be stored underneath the ground. They have a relatively deep system of energy storage capacity within their crowns. So it does take time and patience, and unfortunately, I can't offer a magic bullet and when it comes to managing those particular species. And even in a field cropping situation, they're not exactly the easiest things to deal with. So it is going to be a combination of that patience, time, and work.
All right.
Is there any problem with just like in a couple, this is at a community garden, just leaving, you know, in the paths and just mowing it?
It's, you know, it will be able to continue to spread a little bit there, but that will hopefully keep the energy capture down quite a bit by keeping it mown fairly close to the ground level. Will certainly help stress it out, cause some problems for it, and hopefully keep it from expanding back into the garden areas.
Black plastic doesn't work at all, by the way.
Doesn't work well, no. You kind of have to do some other things with it. I mean, if it's tight enough to the ground and heavy enough plastic, it usually does, but it's not perfect either.
Yeah. Thanks, Pat. Appreciate the call. Ricky in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, next. Hi, Ricky.
Hey, boys. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So basically, I got a big problem, okay? I got all these little bugs of some sort. I don't know if they're fleas or ticks or whatever, but they're on my plants, and it's just like I got to get them off. I got to do something. It's got to be organic, you know. I got all these bugs on my plants. I want to know how to get them off. I got a whole bunch of hash oil I got to make real soon, and I got to get these bugs off the plants. Got to figure out something organic, you know. And I just, I'm like,
well, hash oil is not something we're going to talk about on the show, I don't think.
I'd prefer not to.
Yeah. Oh, a little jokester there. Let's go to Mandy in La Crosse. Hi, Mandy.
Hi there. I have this weed that has taken over our hillside. It backs up into a forest. I'm pretty sure that it's that the sticky, very, very sticky one. It'll just, like, hang off my hand if I'm not even holding it. And I've been told it's called Cleaver. It seems to match on the online description, but we're just not sure how to get rid of the thing.
What else is growing there that you care about? How's that?
Well, we've got a lot of Jack in the Pulpit up there, so that's why we're kind of trying to rescue the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and as with most situations, you know, when you're not wanting to completely redo an area, it really almost eliminates herbicidal options or exceptionally limits the possibilities. Yeah, you may have to do, again, kind of a combination of things where you're, I guess part of it is, though I should have backed up, how thick is the patch, you know, how big is it, you know, those are things that are going to come into play with what you're willing and able to do, you know. Again, we mentioned this a little bit before, but the key to winning the battle in the long term with any kind of a weed situation is preventing the ability of that weed to spread. So for most species, that's stopping seed production. That is the key. The problem is you have to do that multiple years in a row because the seed bank in the soil is going to be able to come back. So, you know, like, I mentioned garlic mustard before. It's a horrible invasive weed. It causes all kinds of problems. It changes the soil. Well, I got blessed with a patch of that when we bought the house that we're living in now. And it's not fun to deal with, and it's going to probably take me a decade and a half to get rid of it, hopefully.
Oh,
but,
boy.
But unfortunately, those are the types of things that we have to do if you are really keen on getting rid of a particular species. Now, if you just want to limit it and manage the number of plants of it that you have to deal with, there you've got more options. You know, you can do plant by plant treatment almost, you know, especially if you're dealing with a perennial type of situation, you can do plant by plant treatment and then really kind of thin it out, weaken those stands, and be able to have more of your preferred plants growing in those areas. But unfortunately, there isn't a single easy answer, especially when you are dealing with good plants that you want to keep.
Yeah.
Okay. And if I want to just wipe out
the whole area?
It's a whole, is it like the whole hill, and we're trying to keep it from moving into our hosta gardens. So, I mean, I hate to just kill off a hillside, but...
Yeah. Well, and if you are willing to go wholesale, then your two options are chemical or tillage or you know, a plastic covering, but it sounds like it's way too large of an area for doing something like that. So, you know, multiple tillage events over the course of a year or sometimes two, depending on what exactly you're dealing with, or either a single perfectly timed herbicide application in a perfect world, but usually even with herbicidal application, you need to do a combination of things because most of our weed species are going to be able to survive just one management thing. We have precious few magic bullets other than literally being able to pull or hoe a weed out and say, yep, you're dead. And when you're dealing with a larger population like that, it is going to take multiple modes of activity to try to get at the base of the energy storage for that plant community.
Okay. And with that, I'm looking online here. It says it's either called Cleavers or Gallium.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that the kind of stuff, if you just pull it and leave it on the ground, it's going to plant itself again?
It depends on how mature, you know, the seeds of most of those types of species do mature pretty quickly. So certainly, you know, like I deal with the garlic mustard, when I pull a plant out, I don't leave anything on the ground. I pull it up, I take it to a concrete spot that gets sun, and I bake that stuff into oblivion, and then I throw it into the outdoor wood burner and burn it just for good measure.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy. You want to be rid of it, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Scott.
But, well, in with things like the mustard family, okay, I drove to Wisconsin, or I didn't drive, but I rode along to with a couple of other extension personnel to Wisconsin Dells yesterday, and one of the things I noticed is that the Dames rocket is in full bloom from basically Green Bay all the way south in the state. And Dames rocket is another invasive mustard. It's a very pretty plant. It's a very robust mustard. It's a short-lived perennial, winter annual, biennial, depending on the individual plant a little bit. But it a lot of people call it spring phlox because it looks like phlox. It is a very pretty purplish, pinkish, white community. But it's really nasty. And that's the same kind of stuff, is that that mustard family of plants, those seeds can live in the soil for decades. If you let them regenerate and reinvigorate that seed bank, you're never going to get rid of them.
Oh. Well, hopefully on a happier note, let's go to Julie in Darlington. Hi, Julie.
Hi, good morning or afternoon. How are you?
Good. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I have a sweet cherry tree, and it's loaded with fruit, just like last year. We netted it so the birds wouldn't eat them completely, but before last year, when we were trying to wait for the perfect time to pick, there was a black insect that was spotted all over it, and I was wondering, did I need to spray? I'm not a big chemical sprayer, but mm-hmm. What would keep those insects from eating the fruit before, because
okay.
The net doesn't keep them out. I just wondered if you had anything.
Well, again, kind of goes back to identification, you know, which specific insect was it? You know, with cherries, one of the groups of insects that we worry about most are actually the flies. There's a cherry fruit fly, there's a black cherry fruit fly, and then there's the spotted winged Drosophila. And they can all impact cherries pretty severely, and you end up with, well, I jokingly call high-protein fruit because you have maggots inside the fruit. And now, if it's one of those, yeah, there are some opportunities to do trapping for both monitoring or for an organic control mechanism. You can try a product like Surround, which is a kale and clay product where you literally whitewash your plants, but they don't like eating the stuff that is coated with it, and they have a little bit harder time laying their eggs through it. And then when you pick them, you can wash off the residue, hopefully, yet. But if it's not one of those fly species, I'm drawing a little bit of a blank on what would be a black smaller insect other than those flies. So if you do see it again this year, as soon as you see it, get a sample to your extension office for accurate identification, because then we can know for sure what to do about it if you don't think it's one of those flies.
Okay. But you said something about a trapping. I mean, there's actual
there's traps that you can purchase or that you can make. You know, for the flies, you can they're pretty easy to actually monitor for them. You can just hang like half-gallon milk jugs or juice jugs in the trees. And this works for almost all fruit trees, is either a monitoring or a partial control mechanism. And then you put water or apple cider vinegar along with fruit, you know, banana peels, apple cores, whatever other fruit material you have, so that it smells like decaying fruit, and they'll get attracted to that. And you obviously have to have holes in the side of the container. I didn't say that, I guess. But and they'll get attracted to that and go into there and die. And for smaller populations, you can actually do fairly good management that way. But at minimum, then you can check those traps and know when they're there, and then be able to apply anything else if you do want to do any extra applications.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how full would I put the jug? I mean, like about a quarter?
Usually around a quarter. Otherwise, they get awfully heavy if you have more than that, and it's hard to keep them supported in the branches.
And just want to hang them. And any other suggestion on how to get the birds out without netting the whole tree? Because the trees get kind of large.
Unfortunately, experience with the other types of repellent things, you know, the owl decoys and all those types of things, is that they basically don't care. When it comes to cherries or some of our other small fruits, you know, the bush fruits, vine fruits, etc., if you really don't feel like sharing most of your crop with the birds, you have to go the route of netting them.
Okay. Correct. Yeah. Okay. That's what I figured. I know I tried some other things and didn't work. Well, I appreciate all your help.
Yeah. Thanks. Yep. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And Vicki in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. I have a question about my barberry bushes. I pruned them way back in the last couple of years, but they have lots of little shoots, little suckers that have been growing out into my yard. And I'm wondering, what is the best way to handle maintaining my current bushes and then getting rid of the little ones?
Okay, yeah. Probably both a combination of seedlings and potentially some root budding going on, although it's not a species that does a ton of that. It's going to be just a combination of either digging them out individually, if you are willing to take the time to do that. I mean, if you keep mowing them off consistently in the lawn, they're not going to survive in the long term because they need more growth potential than that. And then as far as managing the individual shrubs, that goes to really how do you want them to look and then matching your timing of the management practices to how you want them to look. You know, if you want them to look more formal versus more informal, that's going to change the timing of your pruning and the way you do your pruning cuts. And especially with barberry, because it's most barberry types are not exceptionally fast growing, but they do enough that they can get ahead of you if you let them.
Yeah, I learned that one.
The hard way. All right, Vicki, thanks for calling.
You.
Yeah, appreciate the call. We had Wendy had to cut down a birch tree because of, she said, the bronze birch borer.
Okay.
She wonders if there what she should do with the wood itself. Is there something she needs to do to get rid of it?
Probably not really much of an issue. I mean, bronze birch borer is endemic to the entire state, so it's not like it's something along the lines of an ash that's been killed by emerald ash borer. But, you know, if you want to kill the insects that are inside of it, the best way to do it is cut it up, split it, dry it out. You know, they'll die pretty quickly then. But there are no quarantines or any legal restrictions on birch wood due to the bronze birch borer.
You mentioned ash trees, and Sarah emailed to ask if she can treat her mature ash tree for emerald ash borer herself. What should she apply?
Yes, you can. I don't have that one with me, but there is actually a Hort series fact sheet. So it's called University of Wisconsin Garden Facts on Homeowner Guide to Emerald Ash Borer Treatment. You can look that up. I could probably come up with the active ingredient if my brain were working perfectly at the second. But yes, the quick answer is yes. You can effectively treat ash trees to protect them from emerald ash borer. You just have to look up the active ingredients and see which one you're willing to do. You can do it yourself, or you can obviously pay an arborist company to do it for you or other landscape professionals. And either way should work fairly well as long as you follow the label properly and use the right rates. And that's where it's tricky for mature ash trees, because you really have to follow those rates according to the diameter of the trees.
Yep. And with that, we're out of time, Scott.
Yeah, figured we were about there.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Scott. Scott Royce, UW Extension Ag and Hort Agent from Marinette County, our guest on Garden Talk. Monday at 11, our computer expert will be back to talk about internet streaming options and take your questions as well. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.